So the Radak was a great defender of Rambam, or one of his defenders in the Maimonidean controversy over Rambam's philosophy and his stance on Trias HaMesim and so on. So, not surprisingly, he is a Maimonidean in terms of his rationalist views. So Radak cites what is really Rambam's position. Now, there are other opinions. I'm going to take the opportunity to spend 5 to 10 minutes now just to sort of give you a little review of Tanakh and what the books look like, aside from Chumash, just so we can sort of have a data set to work with when you speak about the Bavli Sufim. Let me first ask the following question. Where did these views come from? What does Chazal have to say about the distinction between the Bavli Sufim? Anyone know? What's that? No. That's not the point of the Sufim. That's whether it seems to be whether a book is being separate Kodesh or not. Whether it was said that the spirit of Ruach HaKodesh / Bible or nothing. What does Chazal have to say about the distinction between the Bavli Sufim? And the answer is, that's what you know about things. Well, could you know anything about this? Because Chazal have nothing to say about it. To the best of my knowledge, there's no halakhic chiluk between the Bavli Sufim other than the fact that we don't read haftaras from Sufim. Well, we do read Megillahs, but we don't read haftaras. Chazal don't distinguish the kedusha level in terms of putting one on top of the other. The Bavli Sufim go together. It's not Nevi'im on top of Sufim, Sufim not Nevi'im. I know.
Because I'll say that at a certain point, then it would stop. And after that point,
like,
Tumim and Nevi'im is separated by
Buddhist,
basically by
Buddhist days.
Like,
well, the Lion, I think I finally taken Lion off the syllabus. Not because I have anything against Lion, but because it's a hard book to use, and the whole issue is speculation. It's a book about canonization of Hebrew scripture. I mean, it's an expansion of the doctrinal dissertation. So Lion suggests periodization, but I'm going to throw you some curveballs with this. What about Mishlei? What about Eel the Gold? So before, I'm sorry? What's that?
Rus.
Okay. What, Rus? What do you mean?
We don't know whether or not it's short to you, whether or not.
We know it's sometime during the Persian Shoftim. By the Yiddish Bar Shoftim, you can debate what point is the Medrash Kitzan Zebolot. Okay, but you also know based upon the generations, assuming no supernatural lens, approximately in the latter period of the Shoftim. Right? There's no, I don't think that issue is debated. Before we talk about that criteria, we'll see, you remind me to come back to three ways theoretically, the obvious ways to distinguish it. Between Nevi'im and Sufim, none of which actually work. See, none of them work alone. Somebody wants to have fun, you can go back and draw models, give points for each criterion. So a book can see if you can then have a delineation of whether a book is, you know, make, whether you get a point, you know, you're not going to get one theory, but you're going to get the historians to tell you multiple causality. Right? Multi-causality. So historians used to work, when you look at historians of the 19th, German historians of the 19th century, and you know, a lot of historians of the early 20th century, everybody had their one pet cause. You were a Marxist historian, you were this kind of historian. You tried to explain everything in light of one particular, you know, great idea. So historians have become a little more sophisticated and realize that there are multiple causes to phenomena. Anyway, so just talking about books, starting in the Nevi'im, the first book in the Nevi'im. The first books of the Bavli Sufim, Mishael and Yehoshua through Malachim, basically are a running history from the time of the entry into and the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. Continuing down, so the Korban Havayim in the Yerbiyahu's time, it concludes with. It's really, after the Korban, you have a very brief account of Gedaliah's assassination, very, very brief. Plus, the freeing from the Nebuchadnezzar's death and the freeing from prison of a former king of Yehuda, which was Yehoiachin, by Evil Merodach. Okay, Evil Merodach, of course, the Akkadian for a servant of Marduk. Okay, we live in an Akkadian is Evet. That's the time frame. What is the nature of the Nevi'im Rishonim in terms of the style of book? How would you describe it?
History.
It's history and historical narrative.
right? It's really, I guess you call it a prose or narrative. Are there any exceptions to the rule of the Virashama? Of the genre? Sorry? Yeah, Shiras Devora, you have Shiras Khan, it's very short, you have Shiras Dothin. You know, but basically historical prose and occasionally here and there, a little bit of poetry and whatever. And the Nevi'im Rishonim is pretty uniform. Are there any other books in Tanakh that look like the Nevi'im Rishonim? No, Esther is not what we call historical narrative. It's a narrative, but it's more literature. It's more Divrei Hayamim. Okay, Divrei Hayamim is the only other book that compares. Divrei Hayamim, which consists of the first 9 chapters are names, and the genealogy, some of it's repeated from the Sanskrit Torah, some of it is new, and the rest of the Divrei Hayamim, and now we're breaking down again the Latin original, probably King James, another total of 65 chapters from our main, 56 chapters of historical narrative again, with a large section in the latter part of the first book of Divrei Hayamim, as we have it broken down, that deals with Binyan Beis HaMikdash and the breaking up of the Levim and the families. A good large chunk there. And most of Divrei Hayamim Beis is parallel to sections of Malachim. Now, it's very interesting. I don't know if anybody's actually, I know a course has been given here in Divrei Hayamim, but it's very interesting to study Divrei Hayamim alongside Malachim, just to see the differences, because there often are differences, and whatever that reflects. It's generally assumed, I think, no matter whether you're from or not from, that Divrei Hayamim is later in some ways than Malachim. Hebrew certainly is much later Hebrew than Adam Malachim. And the reason Divrei Hayamim is referred to frequently, Divrei Hayamim Malachi Yehuda and Divrei Hayamim Malachi Yisrael, we certainly don't have Divrei Hayamim Malachi Yisrael, but the Divrei Hayamim Malachi Yehuda frequently is the same from Shmuel and the Malachim will say, yeah, a little bit about a king's life, and then it says, yes, sir, you know, the Rey so and so, Elohim Sim Lasek, the Rey Sim Lasek, you've done. That's probably not Aaron the Rayamim. It may have been a work from which Aaron the Rey Hayamim drew. In other words, the author of the Rayamim, Chazal Ezra, probably drew upon whatever sources, maybe perhaps multiple sources at his discretion. Now, after you finish the Vim Rishon, you may get to the Vim Acharonim. And you have 4 of the Nevi'im Acharonim, Yeshayahu, Yeriyahu, Yechezkel, and then you have a collection of books of Koyasar. For the most part, how would you describe the content of these books?
Poetry.
It's poetry. Now, there are exceptions to the rule. In Yeshayahu, you have some exceptions, a smaller amount. Yeshayahu, you have Parat Lamed Vav and Lamed Ches, which is purely historical narrative, it parallels the material found in Malachim about Yishai and Chizkiyos HaFerim and so on. You also have a little bit at the beginning of the Sefer, small pieces of Kiyos HaFerim here and there that just provide historical setting for the poetry. You parrot Zayin with Achaz, a little bit, not very much, here and there. But for the most part, everything in those 4 chapters is poetry. Yeriyahu. Actually, Shah is my name. I didn't realize that for a long time. It's Yirmiyahu. It's not something we're having in mind. Everybody pronounced it because of the unit that follows is Yirmiyahu. But it's actually. Tushbah. Believe it or not. The same Yirmiyahu had in it. Mostly again poetry, but to a greater extent, a much longer section of historical narrative, with a little bit interspersed in the fairly large. I mean, probably from Perakos Hay to Perak Mem Beis, maybe Mem Gimel even. It's more historical narrative than poetry. This poetry may soon maybe a couple of chapters. Kalmar Shemasafim and Barnsley the Parakos Torah for last Friday, it's affecting Lamed Aleph, Parak Lamed Aleph. So you do have some poetry, there's a lot of historical narrative. The Korban, the whole story of Gedaliah comes in, the early men, the full story about what happened to Gedaliah. Probably most of you never learned it, and most of you never learned it. If you're looking for a sefer to learn first, if you really haven't done the Gemara Torah well, and you're looking for a sefer to start with, I recommend starting from Nero. It's the easiest to do.
partially because of this historical narrative. The rest of the tape, the beginning and the end, is once again poetry. And then you have the next yes.
Why would you call it poetry? It is
rebuke, but the rebuke is not, it's not like you would, you know, somebody getting into a Musser Shmooze in the classic sense of speaking in, you know, what I would call it, like prose. It's pointing, you know, let me give you one thing which you don't find typically in prose, I don't get this from this historical narrative, is you don't find, you know, parallelism, you know, duplicative parallelism, which the Rishonim call Kefalamin Dominion Shabbos. You won't find that. But much you find it much more frequently in the poetry review. You're right, some of it borders in between. You know, it's not most of it is not quite as poetic as the Shiras Devarim. Of course, what you mean by poetic there is incomprehensible. Right? That's what you mean. Oh, you guys, you know, you just did Hazinu. How many did Shaimi by the Tiger of Hazinu? To get to Shaimi, how many of us what are the words in it? Hazinu is one of the probably the most difficult passages in the Torah. You know, but and what's probably one of the most difficult passages in the Torah, I should say every day, but you actually go through all the words, is Az-Yashir. Those are the most difficult passages, because they're poetry. Hasidim is particularly difficult. Az-Yashir is a little bit easier. So again, it's all a question of degree, you know. But I think I think I'd still call most of the poetry. Okay. So that's what the Yechezkel basically is more of the same. There's very little narrative in Yechezkel. There's no the last chapter here in Yerba, it also parallels Malachi, the last part of Malachi. Pure narrative. Yechezkel, there's nothing that we can describe as anything extended historical narrative. A few places, I think, even earlier in the Sefer, you have a description of Yechezkel's interaction with the Canaan, which is that positive interaction, and a couple of settings for who was involved in being characterized. So the rest of it is poetry, including you get to the 40th chapter. The 40th chapter, to the end of the Sefer, paragraph 10, deals with the description of the futuristic base of Mikdash, whatever exactly that is or was. A future Mikdash, because they're not the second base of Mikdash. Treyasar is really basically smaller books. There is very, very few of the books on anything that could be called historical narrative. Maybe a Yonah, perhaps, if it even happened. I assume, despite the fact that Yonah story going to happen. For a rationalist, you might not expect that, but nonetheless. Maybe a vision, but... Who lived that long? Anyway, so there's very most of it is poetry. Haggai maybe not as much, some of it, but even that mostly is a little piece here and there. It's mostly smaller books, obviously. There are 67 fucking broken down an hour Tanakh. And there are 12 books, and so if you're not talking about, Hoshea, the whole prophet, I'm sure, but it's still probably the longest book of the Haryat. A lot of visions, something commented to me on the Ramadan, which is poetry and vision as well, the Haryat, a lot of those. One of the things that's commonly found, not in the Treyasar, but in the three big books of the Bible, each of them has a long section on prophecies to the nations directed against the nations of the world. Yeshaya starts, I think, in Perek Yud Gimel, and goes in about 10 prophets in Yirmiyahu, which is near the end, in the last, before the last part of the last seven chapters. And Yechezkel is in Hus, and going into the lines. Okay, so that's the Neum Achronim. Okay, those books until now, leaving out the Rayam, are all in the Neum. Okay, eight books. Ksuvim includes the Rayam, and then it includes the Chamesh Megillos, first, but I would start with those. I think most of you are familiar with Esther. That is what I would call a very fine and developed literary story of the Purim story. You probably all know Rus, which is more of a historical narrative. I mean, again, it's not classic historical narrative, it describes a very short time for events, but it's really written in the style of historical narrative, the language of historical narrative.
And then, those are probably two books most of you know reasonably well, because when they're read, you know, so probably actually can sort of follow what's going on. The other books are not as easy. Shir HaShirim is poetry, straight out poetry. It's a love song. Chagall and Mr. Shir HaShirim is a love song between Rabban Shalom and Knesset Yisrael. Koheles. No one really understands Koheles, but I mean, we do understand Koheles, but we don't really, you know, there's no single message. That a lot of extremely contradictory themes in philosophy. Koheles is what we would refer to as wisdom literature. Okay, philosophy almost. Okay, but rather than being expressed, what I guess we say didactically, it's expressed, you know, metaphorically. It is somewhat didactic, but it's literarily expressed. It's not a philosophy textbook. Eicha is a kind of poetry, a sad poetry, basically. But that's what it is. And finally, that covers the Megillus for you. Okay. Now, Sefer Ezra Nechemia is basically more historical narrative. Some of his pieces in Ezra, primarily in Aramaic, a little Nechemia, it's regarded as one book. There are also a lot of lists of names. Long lists of names in Ezra Nechemia. Basically, it's historical narrative along the model of the Devarim also. Okay? It just focuses on a narrow period, the post-Korban period. The chronology is totally confusing to us. Which Persian kings, the one exactly Ezra was, the one exactly Nechemia was, if you're just reading the Sefer, Chazal presents a certain idea, but certainly just in the Sefer itself, it's very hard to get a sense. Then that leaves Daniel, which is a funny kind of book. Daniel is partially historical narrative, and then visions and so on. It's more historical narrative, but it's a funny book. It's half Aramaic, half Hebrew. You should read it in your spare time.
Okay.
And finally, you have the Sifrei Emes, okay, Iyov, Mishlei, and Tehillim, which are really stand out in their own right. Okay, Iyov, and I think they would Tehillim. I'll start with Tehillim. Tehillim is going to be easier. Tehillim is basically each chapter is its own topic and it's an independent work in fact for the most part. There may be certain sections that come together. But each chapter basically is its own mizmor, and Hazal assume there are 10 people that were responsible and thought put it together. The Malcolm already writes, there's other opinions from Hazal that some of them were composed later. But basically, it's a work of, you know, 160 independent poems. For the most part, they are prayers, they are songs of thanksgiving, or various things related to that. I mean, some are phrases, some are supplications. That's basically what it looks like. The style is more poetic. It's not narrative. It's not, I don't think we call it prose. Yeah.
How
does
the Hebrew phrase have to have some uniform language?
Why do they?
Why don't they?
Well, I don't know why. The Aramaic and Hebrew part. I mean, the answer to that is really Hebrew. The simple answer to that is that they were written at different times. And because with the exception of Torah, which we assume is a very good patient, everything else is written in the style of the author, in the language. That's the way the Rambam might describe the author will see a vision if he writes down in his own words. And therefore, you expect that if, you know, when Navi writing in the early part of the Bais Rishon period writes in 9th century biblical Hebrew, and Navi writing or a Ruach HaKodesh or whatever the distinction is writing in the 6th century post Shiva's Theo is going to write in a slightly different biblical, he's going to write in the biblical Hebrew of the 6th century. You expect language to develop. Why certain passages in Aramaic? Well, hard to know. I mean, there are four passages, four books in the Torah that have truly Aramaic. The Torah, as Yigar Sadusa, is not really an Aramaic passage. It's saying, not before the Dalai Lama called Yigar Sadusa. Yirmiyah has one pasuk in Aramaic, and that's probably in Aramaic because it seems to have been a letter sent. You know, the epistle sort of stands out as a unit. Ezra and Nehemiah also are letters. Now, parts of it are, not all of it, but it starts with letters that were probably written in Royal Aramaic, and then for some reason stays in Aramaic. I don't think we know why. Daniel, I don't know. Daniel is an interesting one. Has anybody here from Daniel? Okay, I mean, with the Aramaic, I don't know. Yeah, in English or in Hebrew Arabic? Sorry?
Hebrew Arabic.
Anyway, it's a very interesting book.
At least you should, one thing you should never forget is that the expression read in handwriting and more comes from Sefer Daniel.
Anyway, so Mishlei, as I mentioned in one of the previous two lectures, is a composite work of different collections of, for the most part, Mishlei Shlomo. Certainly, if you get to the last chapter or two, it's all Mishlei Shlomo, with different collections. And it's marked. First paragraph begins with Mishlei Shlomo David, ninth paragraph Mishlei Shlomo, 26th paragraph begins with, or the 25th paragraph, and then you get some old stuff at the last chapter or two, which is tricky for the Noel, whoever the Noel is. But whatever it is. So you have Mishlei, it's again with classic wisdom literature. You can find such literature elsewhere in the ancient Near East. They've discovered Egyptian wisdom literature, I think, in the 10th century. There are a lot of common denominators, that's not really surprising. Wisdom literature, on at least Mishnah for Mishlei, Lefi Pshuto, is simply about wisdom, about proper behavior, and so on. Chazal, and it's a Chazal, but certainly traditionally often interpreted as a mashal for Torah being the Chachma. But even without that level, you can read as much as you gain from Sefer Mishlei on a Pshat level. That's wisdom literature. And then Eo is probably, to some extent, also, not quite, it's wisdom literature in one sense. Eo, basically, it contains three chapters of historical narrative. The first two chapters and sort of the last half of the last chapter, okay, are basically what we call historical narrative. In fact, the Balaam and Solar, when they put the truck in, the Sifra and MS have their own truck. Most of the symbols overlap some, but they often have different meanings. But those three books are set apart from the other 21 books. Except that Eo's first two chapters, the last half of the last chapter, actually have the regular shop of the other 21 Svarim. The rest of Eo, which is really the poetry, has the Ta'amei Emes. Now, the book basically consists of the following storyline. Chazal were a little troubled by it. The idea that the Satan incites God, okay, that expression disturbed Chazal immensely. It should disturb anything, you know. Religious being immensely. Satan incites God to pass the Eo, and Eo loses everything pretty much. And then the beginning of Paragimel, Eo's three friends come to comfort him, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Sofar. No, Elihu is not one of the three friends, Elihu is the young one. Sofar, Namati, Eliphaz, Tachimani, and Bildad, Shulchan. They come to comfort him. What you get is, I think, two rounds of Eo speaks, a friend responds. Eo speaks, a friend responds. The responses get nastier progressively. So you have two rounds of friend one, friend two, friend three, responding to Eo, and then finally you get it repeated. And then, after Eo gets the last word in, it goes on at some length, and then Eo stops. I think it's a Talmud of Eo, it's in the Paragam Aleph. And then Elihu, who has waited patiently, says, okay, I don't know if you guys are smarter than the elders would speak, but obviously, he said, Amarki Aminiyat Yilabeiru, it's brought that years to speak, wisdom comes to age. Then he said, realize that wisdom doesn't always come to age. It's a hangu achimena. Some people have it, some people don't. So then Elihu goes on to defend God against Eo. And then after Elihu is finished speaking, there's no response to Eo. And then God appears in a whirlwind to Eo and responds to him. Seems that Elihu was right. Now, for some reason, he isn't exactly sure what Elihu said, or what Elihu said, and no one really understands Eo. The primary question that the book of Eo is about is the opposite, right? Justice of God. That's really the question. What Chazal considered the single most vexing philosophical, religious, theological problem was Tzadik Gerala. That was what Chazal considered. How do I know, by the way, that Chazal considered that the most vexing problem? What's that? Correct. Now, when you read that, if you're thinking about making a sophisticated manner, I don't think Chazal understood what Moshe asked God, but he said, I already know the Rebbe. But when Chazal tell you that when Moshe Rabbeinu was asking you, that Moshe Rabbeinu had one session with the Golden Dawn, you have to ask him one question. Chazal tell you that Moshe Rabbeinu asked about Tzadik Gerala, you know for sure one thing, you know what Paul Chazal was than anything else. And that's what the book of Eo is about. It's about Tzadik Gerala. No one really knows what the answer is. Okay. No one still knows what the answer is.
Anyway, so that's basically an overview of Tanakh. Now, Nevi'im Rishonim and Yeshaya Yirmiyahu Yechezkel and Yisrael and Yaharim as the name of it is comprised of everything else. And the question is, why? By the parenthetically about that last side, took a little longer than I expected, but I'm very glad that I did it. I really wanted the course to be designed around that rather than speaking about the larger issues actually. See, this is very good to come out, but in the next time to be designed things. So why are certain books in the Bible and why are certain books in the Bible? So, okay, so guys, so who started? Somebody was telling me earlier, Benjamin. He said, you read the Radak, the Radak said, Nevuah versus Ruach HaKodesh. Okay, let me ask you a question. How do you know whether somebody's a Nevi or not? The Radak describes the difference between Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh. Nevuah, you lose, Ruach HaKodesh, basically you're under normal physical being and you're just inspired by God. Nevuah, you lose your physical faculties, except for Moshe Rabbeinu. Everybody has lost their physical faculties, full control, but how do we know? You want to find out whether X was a Nevi, or whether Chazal thought X was a Nevi, how do you find out? Look at the Gemara Megillah Daf Yud Aleph, and you have a list of 48 Nevi'im, 7 Nevi'is. Well, presumably you would, but the Rambam seems to have ignored that, because the Rambam writes, if I'm not mistaken, that Shlomo wasn't a Nevi, he only had a HaKodesh, which would explain to the Rambam and the Radashti as to why Mishlei and why Shir Shirin and why Kohelet are in Sukkah. The only problem is, of course, if I'm not mistaken, Shlomo appears in that list in Megillah.
I listened to the Rashi,
what's that?
The Gemara said you're right, but
it's in Rashi. So I guess I should stress that question. Okay. I guess there's nothing to prove. Is there one other... What does Rashi quote as the Raya? Right, the list is in Rashi. So Rambam helps on fine. Good. It's not my question or bother. Okay. So fine. So Shlomo is not a Navi. That's what the Rambam says. Okay, what about Dovin? I think he says the same thing about Dovin. Right. Okay. Well, let me ask you a question. What about Ezra? Yeah. Yeah, his book is in the Nevi'im. Why is Eicha in Sukkah? If you accept Chazal, the Rambam may not have any opinion to mention that Ezra's Emalachi. So the books that Ezra wrote, so Ezra, Chemi, and Debra, Yemen, perhaps, those also could qualify. So the theory, it's nice you can do away with the Tehillim and Mishlei, but you really can't explain how the books based upon that theory. So the first model, I said there are three models for how you can distinguish between Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So I only suggested historical, chronological, right? We'll come back to that. But the Radak's model is inspiration, the level of inspiration, the quality of the authorship of the book. Authorship being my authorship of the book. Okay. Chazal, by the way, again, Chazal doesn't say you can make any sense. And it's not clear to Chazal what exactly the difference between Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh is. I mean, not that those terms are used in such a fashion, and certainly that's the difference between Nevuah and Ksuvim. Okay. So what about the historical one? Does the historical one work? Well, let's look. Let's talk about what's in Ksuvim. Rus, early or late?
Early.
Shir HaShirim?
Early.
Koheles?
Early.
Esther?
Late.
Late Eicha? Well, it's been late as Yirmiyahu, right? Okay, you say that's the dividing line, okay? You wrote Eicha at the end of the okay. Okay, let's see what else you have. Treyasa. Haggai, Chaya, Malachi? Late, right? By Chazal's chronology, not necessarily, not necessarily by scholars, but by Chazal's chronology, what books in Tanakh would come later than Haggai, Chaya, Malachi? Esther, Debra, Yamin? John Neal. That's it. It's contemporary. Then Paul has an FM if you want. Okay? Not. Sefer Emes should be much earlier. Kohelet, Shira Shirin, Rus are much earlier. You can explain some of Sufim, but not a lot of Sufim. A large chunk of Sufim you can't explain. More than half of Sufim you can't explain that way. Any other possibilities of distinguishing? Yeah. What do you mean? I think you're not using the correct word. Okay, subject matter is. What do you mean he's talking to? And y'all explain further. What do you mean? Say, what kind of subject matter belongs to the Nevi'im, what belongs to the Kohanim?
The Nevi'im would be like, things, not necessarily that were written by it, but things that they do in the
things that you're not liking the distinction in the middle. You see, when you, even when you read the Nevi'im and the Radak, you're less scratching your head, sort of. They grapple with different aspects of the problem. The word they're looking for is a French word, a genre. G-E-N-R-E, we've seen it before, in a long time before I mentioned that better. Genre, which means the style of literature novel. You would think, you know, you would say that Musser, the review, poetic review, or maybe not poetic, maybe, you know, content, in better words, you know, might be, you know, Nevi'im and other things going to what types of things you have. We have historical narratives. We have poetry. We have wisdom literature. And we have, you know, narrative literature, if I can call it that way, Esther. And so you might argue that certain things go with Nevi'im and perhaps Sufim is everything else. There's a problem with this. What's the problem with this approach? What are different hayyamim? Explain to me why different hayyamim isn't Sufim, but Malachim is in the end.
Any category is in the end, it also has stuff like
that. Okay, so I'll say Rubok Kikula. Okay, I'll go with that. In a sense that Chazal decided, again, unless you adopt the Ruach HaKodesh position versus the Ruach being something inherent in the book, there's not a lot of differences between the end and Sufim that are listed. Other than HaKodesh, but that's, you know, so it's not significant. In other words, the fact that Chazal decided to something in the name of something Sufim doesn't really matter that much, unless you claim that it really has to do with the level of prophecy or something like that. Okay, so the truth is there's no, you may have to adopt multiple pieces, you know, take approach that it has to be written by a Navi and it needs something else. It's not entirely clear. How old is the division, by the way? How far back does this division go? Any thoughts? Ezra?
At least
go ahead.
At least the Gemara said that.
And give me a date. What was the date on that Gemara? Early 3rd century at the latest. Right, the Brisa. It's Tana Idik, so it can't be later than that. More than that, we can't say. Now, that leads me to the second question. The second question is, how did a book make it into Tanakh? How do you know what's in Tanakh? Two ways you might know. Brisa, or you might open up your Tanakh. Tanakh, and that's what's in here. You have to be careful, because some Tanakhs have other books in them too. I remember once finding in my parents' basement a book, and I saw after this book, after Devar Yamin, and it was in Hebrew, and it started, I think, that it had three names in it. And at first I didn't realize what it was. The last name was Yeshu. Or maybe it was a full chronology or something like that. And Devar Yamin starts Adam Shes Anosh, the first pasuk. Took me a while to figure out what it was. I subsequently realized what it was. I did choose to tear it out of the book and throw it out, which I shouldn't have done, but it truly wasn't necessary, but in my zealous youth I did. But it was a Christian Bible, you know, in Hebrew. Probably it deserved to be torn out because it was probably meant for proselytizing purposes as opposed to just being a collected volume for anybody who's interested in reading it. But anyway, so there are 24 books in Tanakh and no more than that. Now there is I call it a quasi 24th book of Tanakh. I mentioned this probably at the end of the last class, which is Sefer Ben Sira. Now where do these books come from? So the truth is, Jews in the Bayesheni period, we have an anachronistic way of thinking about people in the Bayesheni period. We have a tendency to think
that there were the Frum Jews and there were the Apikoresim. And everybody that wasn't a Frum Jew was an Apikores. I suspect had you asked people, including the Frum Jews, in the Bayis Sheni period, I'm not sure those are the terms they would have used. I know this is a little bit, it may be disturbing to some people, but you know, the people at Qumran, the people who were responsible, whether they lived there, who were responsible for the writing of many of these sectarian works of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were more machmir than the Pharisees. They seem to resemble Sadducean positions. It's not entirely clear. But they were much more machmir, right? They weren't less, whatever that means, frum, that's an anachronistic term. They were more machmir. They had stricter interpretations in many ways. And it's not a question of Torah Shabbat Sa versus Torah Shabbat Peh. Again, they may not have been strict Sadducees. The Sadducees, we believe, didn't believe in Torah Shabbat Peh based upon Josephus' comments. That's where they originated from, although Chazal never say it explicitly. The Gemara itself never explicitly spells out that the Sadducees didn't believe in Torah Shabbat Peh. I think it really comes... The Rishonim do, and I think some of this comes... What's that? Or Yosefon, I don't know. It may have been an extrapolation from some of the positions that are found. I mean, the classic ones in Machoras HaShabbos, but calendar was always a big issue. But the other examples are not that. If you look in the Mishnayos and Yodayim that contain a series of disputes, Kol Dum Aleichem, Stukim, Prushim, they're not about Torah Shabbat Peh versus Torah Shabbat Sab. They're about interpretations. That's different Torah Shabbat Peh. So Jews were doing lots of interesting things in the Bayis Sheni, and there were lots of groups. Now, if we believe Josephus, which we usually tend to with a grain of salt, most of the people followed the Pharisees, who were the ancestors, intellectually speaking, of Chazal. Josephus says that that Yanai told Shlom Tzion, his wife, on his deathbed, be with the Pharisees because the people are with them. So that at least is the one piece of evidence that we do have, even historians have to at least grapple with, that the Hamon seem to have been affiliated with the Perushim. Okay, but Jews were doing different things, and Jews did a lot of interesting things, including producing a lot of literature. Most of that literature has survived for traditional Jews primarily in Midrashim. Many interpretations, and you can read the. We will speak about this when we do Agadah. You know, the Rambam's assumption very clearly is Agadah is not. I don't want to say it's not part of Torah Shabbat Peh, but it's really not. It's not Misinai. It's not part of the corpus of Torah Shabbat Peh in the same way Halacha is. However, a lot of our Agadah is very, very old. You know, our Midrashic collections may be late. The earliest Midrashic collections, you know, aside from the little Medrash Agadah in the Mechilta and things like that, in the little Sifrei, most of our Agadah collections don't come from earlier than the 5th century. But many of these ideas can be traced back at least 700, 800 years earlier, well into the Bayis Sheni period. And one of the sources we have for seeing that with our own eyes are these books that were written by Jews in the Bayis Sheni period but never became part of Tanakh. They are books known as, collected in collections known as the Apocryphon Pseudepigrapha. Now, the terms Apocryphon Pseudepigrapha don't mean anything. Meaning, Pseudepigrapha has a meaning. Pseudepigraphic work means something that was fraudulently, or that may have once been a common thing. I don't know if they regarded fraud the way we do. They may have attributed a book and attributed it to somebody else. There's a book in this pseudepigrapha, I don't mean photographer. Those two collections, by the way, just happen to be which church has preserved them. If I'm not mistaken, except the early Catholic Church canon may only have the Apocrypha. Right. Other early churches preserve more books. And you know, I think the Ethiopian Church may have the largest collection, I'm not sure. The Jew release we only know because of mostly the Ethiopian versions. So a lot of these books contain, you know, when you have, you know, spare time, someone asks me, can you read them in the bathroom or not, which is an interesting question. I think the answer is no, because it's Perushim on Tanakh. It's probably done by Jews. Now, of course, those Jews, if they were living today, would be regarded as heretics. I don't know. I know this seems to be a radical statement, but I'm curious if someone can produce evidence once you get to the beyond manuscript changes. It can produce any evidence that the Sadducean's contemporaries regarded them as heretics. They had very strong disagreements with them, but you don't find, see if you can find, you know, the Mishnah referring to the Sukkim as heretics. And I'm not sure that you'll find that. I'm not even sure where. You might find the Gemara, but I'm not sure. Yes. No, clearly there were very strong differences. Right, and they didn't want to allow them to do their practices in the base of Mikra.
Even though from that Gemara, we also find that the base is a bit older.
Okay, but Vaikusim also works Surya and Mikdash. Right? In other words, we have this tendency. You wouldn't have, today you couldn't, and this is really going into the collection history course, but you wouldn't allow a reformed Jew to get up to be in class and on the right, right? There's no chance. Now, the most left-wing modern, I think, well, I say most left-wing, but most mainstream modern Orthodox Jews, whatever that means, would be appalled by the idea, right? Please, though you're talking, you know, though you're only so far, right? But here you have Vaikusim, you know, serving in the Mikdash. So our concept of what's the Machana, what's the Machana, really revolves around a different model. I'm not that going into that. So coming back to our issue of these works, the Apocrypha and the Sutra preserve a lot of content of biblical interpretation of by the change period.
There are similar stories found in the Apocrypha.
Correct. The Kishon HaEsh story, probably the earliest occurrence of something really along those lines, I believe, is in the Book of Jubilees. Okay, which is probably, Book of Jubilees is generally some debate as early as the 3rd century before the Common Era. But there are a lot of interruptions that you will see. The very famous book, The Death of the Ascension of Isaiah, I think it's called, in the Sinai Book, is basically the source. I mean, it may not have been, even had the book, but it was maybe orally transmitted. The source from the Gemara and Yavama, Stachan Tess, and they describing the death of Yeshayah, is based, you can see it, it's earlier form, in this particular supergraphic work. It's a short work, you can read it, you can read the Gemara too with it. So you will see a lot of things are preserved, are really come from much earlier traditions that you already see reflected in these relatively early Vayishchenyi works. I need no distinction between the two of them. I may use one term, but they appear, you know, comes in both. Okay, now the one book that's most interesting is the book of Ben Sira, because Chazal, Ben Sira, firstly, what type of literature is it? It's wisdom literature. It looks, the Hebrew, we don't originally have it in Hebrew, it's a back translation. They found some fragments of Quran, which I believe prove that it is, in fact, really Hebrew originally. But many of these books you only have preserved in one language. Greek, but that's what the Catholic Church, the early, I guess we call the Catholic Church, at its early stage, used the Septuagint, the LXX, which is in Greek. That was really their Bible, the later moved to Latin. But we have these works preserved in Greek. And the question is, what was their original language? You never know for sure, but it's generally assumed that it's Hebrew. Yeah.
They have that in their Septuagint.
No, because the only story that only applies to the Phoenician Chicago. The whole question is where the other books come from. And clearly, the different books that don't come from the same hand in terms of the Greek style. So they talk about actually Ben Sira's grandson, who wrote some type of an introduction to the book which we have. Ben Sira's grandson, I think it's clear already, I think the Zion had been translated by them. The Septuagint translation itself goes back to the early 3rd century. I think Kuleyama pretty much looked pretty young. But if it's only a Hamishim Shakur, it's not of Nevi'im. I think we know Nevi'im was kind of translated by the end of the 2nd century, before the Common Era.
That's BCE before.
Yes. Bad. Yes. The Church wasn't responsible for these Greek translations, they just preserved them. Okay, anyway, we will talk a little bit about Septuagint when we get to the Targum section in the second half of the course. We'll talk about Septuagint then. Okay. Does anybody know what the Septuagint is? Okay. So I'm sorry. I'll just say two lines of that and leave it there. The Gemara Megillah records a tradition that Ptolemy Hamela, one of the Egyptian successor to Alexander the Great, or his generals succeeded him and conquered or controlled the southern part of the empire. Ptolemy, at Kisili Karas Masharachim, he took 72 elders, put him in the separate rooms, and they all came up with the exact same translation with the same changes. As a friend of mine once said, observed that that's not such a miracle, it would have been a bigger miracle if the 72 were the same when they came up with the same translation. Okay. Putting that aside, and the Gemara lists several changes that they say were in the Septuagint, that Chazal changed so it's not the misleading people. Okay, so the Gemara Megillah, I think it's about Tess, about Yud, and I first crack in Megillah. Fine. Septuagint, by the way, itself, although there's not much, that more literal translation, also serves as early biblical interpretation, as is every Targum. By definition, a Targum is there's no such thing as a pure translation. Virtually impossible. A translation always implies to some degree interpretation. Some definition. We'll talk about that when we get to Targum. Okay. But the question is, why did Ben Sira not make it into the canon? Well, it sort of did, it sort of didn't. Chazal sometimes quoted the scripture, We don't really know why. The Gemara says that
Rabbi Akiva says, according to Svarma Hitzonim, has no fan of the one above. So Rabbi Yosef says, the Sefer Ben Zvira.
So Abaye then asks, what's wrong with Ben Zvira? He starts to quote passage after passage after passage and show you how the same ideas sound in Mishlei, Tanah, and Tadah. What's so bad about the book? Finally, they find a passage with a diet from why it's so good. And then the conclusion, I think Abaye says, or Yosef himself says, that but me and Ali should be Sfei Darshina. The good parts you can study. And of course, the part that the Gemara didn't like, we don't even have all this here. Okay? Interestingly enough, I haven't looked at it in a long time, but if I'm not mistaken, Ben Sira's description of Shimon Kohen Gadol, this glowing ode to the high priest, has a lot of echoes of that in our Ari Kohen. Okay, at least I know Kippur. It shouldn't disturb you. You should realize how all that should inspire you, how ancient the prayer Ari Kohen was. Ben Sira was a good Jew. At least even in the Babli school. Now, Yushami actually took a harder line on Ben Sira. It's not clear why. Perhaps more likely because they actually knew more about Ben Sira. Because Ben Sira, if it was in Greek or whatever they had, it was more likely preserved in Eretz Yisrael, which is why they put out all these books. And they say that Ben Sira and somebody else should be burned. Homer is one of them. Sifrei Homer is fine, that's one thing. But Ben Sira, you shouldn't. Should read it. It's not clear what Yerushalmi says. If you learn the Babli, look at the Infinite Nine, it'll tell you where Yerushalmi is, and you move on from there. Whatever. Anyway, I wanted to focus just a few minutes, I'll tell you a question in a second, on one book that you were asked to read, the Book of Susanna, which is an interesting book, and talk about, so I want to have 2 points. One, why does it not include in Tanakh? And is there anything problematic in the book, or before you get to that, why would Chazal have or not have included it? And then, I want to point out one very interesting historical aspect, literary story, and see if anybody recognized it in Chazal. Okay? Now, what was the question? Yes?
So, you mentioned Homer
as
an Odyssey?
Yes.
Is that long ago in the same
country? No, but it is preserved. People knew. People today still have the Iliad and the Odyssey preserved. So, Sifrei Homer are not as problematic as Ben Sira.
What
the Odyssey did? I think it is 8th century. I don't know, any classic people? Yeah. 8th, 9th century before the Common Era. I don't know when they're assumed, at what point stage they were oral or what stage they were assumed to be written. But I think that's what I believe the Odyssey dates were too. But I don't know. My area is not classic. Okay, what about the storyline? What's the storyline of Susanna?
I hope you all read Susanna.
And two others try to seduce Susanna.
Okay, so the story basically goes, you have this beautiful woman, Susanna, and these two elders have a great idea. And they want to sleep with her. So basically they catch her alone in the garden. Okay, and they threaten that if she refuses to sleep with her, that they are going to testify that she committed adultery and get her killed. And there she is. Well, she hadn't quite fully learned the sugya of the Herga Yapur, otherwise she would have had no suffering. Okay, but then she basically decides she'd rather face the wrath of man than the wrath of God, and she decides to refuse their entreaties, and then they come. Witnesses come and testify that she committed adultery, and they're going to kill her. And then the wise man Daniel shows up, okay, and he is going to start to investigate the witnesses. And he asks them, under what tree did this take place? And one of them says tree A. And then he asks the other one, that says tree B. Because you scoundrels, I thought you were lying, and they kill the witnesses. Okay. Now, the story obviously has a certain kind of resonance with Bnei Beis Medrash, because these are concepts that are hopefully at home. Now, there are at least two passages in Chazal that this should resonate with. There's also a problem. What passage does this resonate with? Well, obviously, there's an issue with Bedikas of Edom. The problem here, of course, is that it's not Edom Zomerman. It's a Yachasha. Okay? Fine. So Chazal knows that you don't kill Edei HaChasha, which could be the reason why
and they refuse to accept the book.
Now, I'm assuming, of course, in choosing to accept the book and not accept the book, that they don't have a clear Masorah, and they don't have, you know, the defining tools to figure out what's written in Ruach HaKodesh. I assume that, maybe I'm wrong, but I assume that because Chazal debated about certain books, whether they were written in Ruach HaKodesh or not. Shimon ben Manasseh held Kohelet as Chachmasa Shel Shlomo. Not part of that. So if they clearly don't have an ironclad Masorah, and they don't have a method of divination. So Chazal, I presume, judged by the contents of the book, by whom they assume the book to be written by, and so on, whether or not the book deserved to be in Tanakh. I can think of other criteria as well. But you can certainly look at certain books and say, this is not there because Chazal thought the following. Yeah.
You could say that this paper looks like it's taking a more literal, like, shattering the idea of something that's going to do it.
Okay, so I mean, that's just me, but the fact is certainly it doesn't come up with Chazal the way Chazal assumed. And they made it more, you know, anti-halakhic, therefore, is or non-halakhic, therefore. Okay, it's a very interesting story. Are there any echoes that you recognize? Yeah.
Referring to what it's kind of condescending on the elders of the age, that maybe people wrote this book have a bad view of
That's an interesting question. What you're saying is not something to be frowned upon, although it's not clear whether that's the theme here, whether the young Daniel, I don't know if he's described as young, here as opposed to even the crooked elders and the incompetent elders. I don't know. That could be a theme there. But that's the theme of the book itself to be addressed. But something in Chazal, these two passages that come to mind. One, which to my mind in Medrash clearly is drawing on a similar type of tradition. The other is this halakhic statement that should remind you about checking underneath your string. Any of you notice that here? Masa, Ubada, and Zakai, the St. Canaanus. Yeah. This is the only exact same kind of question, right? Same kind of. One doesn't indicate dependence upon it, and the other, it's just very interesting, a striking similarity. I'm sorry? I understand. The bottom line is, I'm not saying it's the same story. I'm just saying you see a similar type of thought of how you investigate things. The other piece is, anyone know the story of Sidkia and Echad? It described by Yirmiyahu as the V.A. Sheker that the Muchanets are toasted in fire. Right. So the phrase is not familiar. The Gemara Chela tells the story of these two false prophets. Sidkia goes to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter and says, sleep with Echad. The Echad said, sleep with Sidkia. And she wasn't quite sure. She went to her father. And this is actually such a wonderful message because it takes so many things from different places. And her father said, doesn't sound right to me. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I think you'd be a sheker, and I'm throwing you into the fire. If you really tell me the truth, you survive. Lachanan, Mishael, and Azariah did. And they say, yeah, but they were three, we're only two. So he says, you take one person with you. And who does he take with him? The Shua ben Yitzhadat, and I got from Zechariah, which of course explains what is Zechariah, why he's the God in Ratzowin. Right, because he went into the fire, but he got singed. Why did he get singed? Sanai and Mishael Adari, all Tadikin. But here, he was thrown in the fire with Super Shine. It's really
business.
What's that? Okay. So that's the Gemara say that he didn't do something he should have done?
Right.
He wasn't Mocha or something?
Yeah, his children.
Okay. Yes. So anyway, you can see that this case, to me, speaks of a very, very great similarities between the two stories. And it wouldn't surprise me that one or the other sort of grows from the other in Chazal context becomes the source for interpretation. How do we remember what a Chazal bothered by in this Medrash? The bothered by him, why did Yirmiyahu mention this to be? Because Muhammad roasted his fire. It's everything, Chazal pulled everything together. But you can see some similar literary themes that can be found in these books, and you'll find them later in Chazal as well. Okay. I don't know exactly. I want to say Tavi Tess, but I'm not sure. I'm not going to go on the money. You know where it is? It's earlier. Okay. I might have it in my notes, actually. One second. That could tell you exactly. So, hold on. I should have it at the end of my notes. Is that right here? Tavi Gimel Amalas. Okay, there you go. You got it, Tess. Okay. Fine.
Okay, now one last question to sort of deal with in this issue of canonization. We know the canon is certainly sealed by the year 240, just in terms of but we can assume it was somewhat sealed earlier, or can we? Now, scholars for a long time assumed that there was a synod at Yavne, and when these decisions were made. Now, I think, by the way, that is, Lyman does as well, and I suspect scholarship has come around to this. That's nonsense. There's no evidence for a synod at Yavne to decide in the books of Tanakh. There are Tanoim of the Yavne period who are debating certain books, two or three books. But it's not clear at all that there's any formal convocation to deal with this issue. It's not clear that this is a one-time process. It may be a gradual process. You had the Mishnah and Shabbos, right? No, it's not in the Mishnah. It's in the Gemara, right? Hananya ben Chizkiya ben Garam, right? And the Gemara says that Baram Zachar Osa Yishlato Shemala Hil Mingna Sefer Yecheskel. Explain the background of Mishnah that Yecheskel had sukkim that contradicted Vayikra, and therefore it was his job to work it out. Otherwise, they were going to be Gones Yecheskel. Okay. Now, what exactly Nignas means is not entirely clear. You can read more about it in Lyman's book. Anyway. We don't really know when the canonization took place. We know Josephus already writes, and Josephus is a contemporary with Yavne. He writes of 22 books, although I think it's usually assumed that they attached Eicha to Yirmiyahu and I think Rus to, I forget what, Shoftim maybe. There's no reason to assume Josephus didn't have the same 24 books, although he probably has a different division than our Nevi'im and Ksuvim, the way it breaks down. Okay. Anyway, there are different canons. The people at the Dead Sea, we don't really know. You probably read lots of popular works about the Qumran scrolls, the Dead Sea scrolls, and you assume that these were the works, of course, of the people who lived there. None of that is in anybody's anyway been any way demonstrated. All we know is that there was a settlement at Qumran, and then not too far from there, but not exactly there either, there was a library found of lots of interesting works. That's what we know about Qumran, okay? And scholars who are doing their job study those works, but we don't know who was responsible for those works. We can only judge from the ideas found within. Most of those works, most of those scrolls, or many of them, I think most, are in fact biblical works, books of Tanakh. Every book of Tanakh is represented there except for Esther. And the fact that Esther is not there doesn't mean that they didn't have Esther in the Tanakh. It just means that many books, Divrei Hayom, had a tiny piece survive. We don't know exactly why it didn't. In addition, the people of the Dead Sea had other holy books. They had their own sectarian works that they treated probably as holy. They copied the Sefer Ahagu, Brit Damesek, and so on. You can study the Dead Sea Scrolls, and you'll see. So different groups of Jews may have had different books they treated as sanctified. We don't really know when canonization took place. And you can see even within Chazal, and I may mention this, that Ben Sira seems to be in flux, because on the one hand you have that Gemara in Sanhedrin that I mentioned. On the other hand, you have a few places in Shas where Ben Sira is quoted as proof text the way you would quote Ksuvim. It's quoted that way. I mentioned one place is in Perakah Chovah where the Gemara says, expressing the idea that the people tend to associate with similar kinds. People like themselves, so they say that Dabar Zan Emra B'Torah, Hakasa B'Torah, Shana B'Nevim, Umashulash B'Ksuvim. The pasuk from Ksuvim is called Ochlamino Yishkon, which doesn't exist in Tanakh. And the Balei Tosfos say, we don't know where this pasuk is, maybe it's from Ben Sira, in fact it is from Ben Sira, and it's not the only place in Shas. They're probably somewhere between 5 and 10 times, I think, that the Gemara quotes Ben Sira, sometimes by name, sometimes not, just as a pasuk. And so it's not clear, you know, none of our Tanakhs contain Ben Sira. I wouldn't venture to say that in Bavel maybe they had 25 books in the Tanakh, I highly doubt it. But the fact that they're talking about it means people are reading it, that's for sure. Okay, fine. Any questions about that? That's unit one. Okay. Yes?
Sure, you get full time. But what about that mission? There's a key statement that anybody needs to correct its own why would we use that for homework?
So the Gemara only says Sefer Minyan. Rabbi Yosef comes along and says Sefer Ben Sira, but then it's qualified by saying that Mili did not Mali said Ispe, so Darshinan.
So basically, only the bad things. So it's not just. What's that?
The statement is
Sefer Chitzonim. But even assume Sefer Minim is not necessarily Sefer Minim. Why you might, under some context, read Christian Bible is a separate discussion. But since we're not talking about that, I'm not going to answer that question now. Many Gedolim did at one point or another. And it wasn't only Dama Shetashiv. But it's not that I recommend that as your first reading. You have many things to read before you get there. Plenty of things to read. Plenty of Mishnayos and plenty of Gemaras. But anyway. So, but as far as that, the Gemara's klal is Milad Mali Sotis Beidarshina. So, I'll leave it at that. Okay? All right. Any other questions? I don't usually get that question, but I expect that if I were teaching a course and I were signing something in Christian Bible to read, I would expect to get that question. I once upon a time did in a strange context, and of course I wasn't teaching, but that's for another time. Anyway, any other questions? Okay, so now we've dealt with sort of authorship and the larger issues of the books that are in Tanakh and why they're in Tanakh, why certain things are not in Tanakh. Now let's talk about the text of Tanakh. So we've already encountered some of this material. We begin with a discussion. Again, we've already read the Eighth Iker slowly and carefully, I think, and I think it's clear what the Eighth Iker does say, and it's clear what the Eighth Iker does not say. Okay, but there still is a popular conception of the Eighth Iker saying something, which I believe was started by the Abarbanel. Yes, David.
It's actually in the Shuvah, when the Rambam went out to it seems a little confusing to me how that works with how we define the Rambam.
Why? Well, how did you read the Rambam there? Okay, I'll take a look in Hilchos Tshuva again, but Hilchos Tshuva is the short version. And the Perashat Mishnayos is the long version. Now, technically speaking, the Rambam does sometimes change his mind. I would tend to doubt he changed his mind on these kinds of issues. So anyway, now there's other reasons for assuming that the Rambam didn't say what he said in the Eighth Iker. A, because he knew better, and because most of the other many, a long list of Rishonim and Acharonim don't assume that way, and it's what we would probably call hard evidence to the contrary. And therefore, we'd rather not have the Rambam's Eighth Iker be read that way, because it would create much more serious problems. you know, I'd rather not have to refer to the Rashban or Kivegra as Api Korsan, according to the Rambam. and they're not alone. It's a long, 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 long list of people who are aware of these issues. Maletosis too. And I would say even going one step further, the Radak. Did you read the Radak in Kriyotzer? Okay, the Radak, who's the name of an Indian, I find it very ironic that the Abarbanel is the one attacking the Radak for his heresy, but how he could say such a thing, because what the Rambam said in the Eighth Iker, the Radak presumably was intimately familiar with the Rambam's Ikar, and nonetheless adopts the position that he does. So let's talk about what is the Radak, we'll get to the Radak in a moment. What does the Sifrei say? Right, the Sifrei would be a problem also. what does the Sifrei say? I assume everybody's read the Sifrei. I'm not going to read it, but you'll tell me what the Sifrei says. What is the Sifrei, first of all? Question you can know without having prepared. What is the Sifrei? Prepared fully. Okay, that's a fair. Okay, so I'm glad I asked that question. The Sifrei is the Medrash Halacha and Dvarim. It is the Tanaitic work. Scholars may debate this issue. It's clear that the Amoraim, early Amoraim, had Midrashei Halacha like the Sifrei, Sifra Mechilta. We don't know that we have their collections of Sifrei, Sifra Mechilta in the same way that we know that Rav Chi and Rav Oshia compiled the Tosefta. We do not have their Tosefta. We have a Tosefta, but not theirs. That's been clearly demonstrated. when you consider that many of the brises of the Gemara, there's no correspondence with the Tana Beruchias and Tana Beruchias found in the Gemara under that name. And our Tosefta, and many of our Toseftas contradict their positions, and many of our Toseftas, the Chachmei Ababli, seem not to know, and so on and so forth. So this is not the Tosefta Beruchia Roshia, that's clear. It's a collection of Tanaitic works, of Tanaitic materials, but it's not that Tosefta. But we know there was a Sifra, Sifra and Mechelta very early on. The Gemara in Sanhedrin attributes its Stam nature, just as we say Stam Mishnah Rabbi Meir, Stam, this is I think in Pei Dalet or Pei Vav, Stam Sifraz Rabbi Yehuda, Stam Sifraz Rabbi Shimon, Stam Tosefta Rabbi Nechemia, fine. Whatever exactly that statement means is another question. But we have these brises, okay? And these brises are different than the Mishnah and Tosefta in that they are organized based upon the Psukim. They're Medrash Halacha is what the term we use for them. Now, when do these collections date from? Theoretically, it could be even pre-Mishnah. My experience suggests, and certainly one of the scholarly positions, is that these collections post-date the Mishnah, like the Tosefta does. Traditionally speaking, starting with Rosh Hiragon, the assumption was that Tosefta post-dates the Mishnah. Recent scholarship, believe it or not, contrary to the normal tendency of the scholarly world, is actually to think that Tosefta may be earlier than the Mishnah, or a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot, maybe large pieces of it that actually represent an earlier form of the Mishnah. In the same sense, maybe argued about the Sifrei and the Sifra and the Mechilta. I'm not convinced. I think that when the Midrash Halacha cite the Mishnah, it's secondary. They're quoting the Mishnah. They're not the source for the Mishnah. Either way, you have Midrash Halacha on only four books of Chumash. Why? Because it's not much to say on Bereshit. There's two myths in Bereshit we can talk about. There's no Medrash Halacha on Bereshit. But Medrash Mechilta, which is the Medrash Halacha on Shmos, begins with Chodesh Adar Lachem and continues on dealing most of the halachic sections with Issa and Agada there. On Mount Sinai, I think there is. And a couple of other things. But basically, by the time you get to the end of Parashat Mishpatim, which is the last halakh section, the Mishkan is not, it's halakhic, but it's not Ledoros, so the Mishkan is not really, it's not discussed in the field at all. After Mishpatim, you have a few psukim in Kisisa on Shabbos, and a few psukim in Vayakel on Shabbos, and that's it. And the Sifra is otherwise known as Taras Kohanim on Sefer HaYikra. You have a Sifrei Bamidbar and a Sifrei Devarim. You have a couple of other that traditionally, it's not clear whether this holds true or not. It appears from the Gemara there were two schools of Midrashic thought. How you darshan Sukkim, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shmuel. You may know that from Shmuel's followed by the fathers of Rebbe and Reboy. It's very hard to define exactly how rigid the distinctions were. So classically, you could assume that the Mechilta and the Sifrei Bamidbar from school 4 are Rabbi Yishma's school, and that the Sifra and Sifrei Devarim are Rabbi Akiva's school. I don't know whether it's true. Mechilta, what's that? School of Kayudar. Rabbi Akiva, yeah. I mean, that's one of the distinctions, let's say it's the only one. Reboot. Look at, is it the first thing in Shavuos or the first thing in the second? I forget where it's early on in Shavuos. There's a long discussion about it. And there's also, by the way, Mechilta the Rashbi, which was reconstructed based upon citations from Yishanim by Professor Yaakov Nachum Eckstein from Tarmel Baruch Hashem University. That is Mechilta the Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Yochai, whose student is he? Rabbi Akiva, he is an Akivai. And there's also a Medrash Tanan in the Brum. I don't know much about it, but it's parallels to Sifrei a lot. Benji? I'm not standing by the assertion that one's Rabbi Akiva and one's Rabbi Yishma. If it's true, by the way, ironically, the Brisa you say every day, Rabbi Yishma Loma, where does that come from? The opening, Taras Kohanim, which should be Rabbi Akiva then. Anyway, what is this phrase saying? Now that I gave a little distraction and maybe educated a little bit, which is perhaps more useful than this phrase. What is this phrase saying? Yes?
You're pointing out like differences from his text and another Torah or another.
not his text. Gimel Sefer Torah in Subah Zara. They found three Svarim in the Azara. Two of them had written in them, Onah, and one in them written in Ma'on. They call that Sefer Ma'on. They dropped one in favor of the two. Then there were two had Na'are and one had Zati Pei, which is a strange word. Not exactly sure what that, what the linguistic origin of that word is. It's Zara that should have been written in the Torah. Ma'onah could be, by the way, same word. One spelled without the hey. It's not inconceivable. You have words in Tanakh, right, that are spelled without at the end, like verbs in Ashkata. You know, the same word a lot at the end, and then you don't. So they couldn't Ma'on could be written Ma'onah without the hey at the end. And then the Hihi issue, right? And for those of you who are Bali Kriya, so you know that this is the nightmare of your existence when you read Parashat Tashiyah Mitzorah, because, you know, is it, you know, is the child calling that hoo 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 or whatever, that's what you mean. What's that? Right, they have an Eastern European accent. All of them. So, apparently, it's funny, it's really only in the Torah. How is it spelled? Normally it's spelled? Hey, Bob Aleph, which is why it's so confusing. Except when you design it 11 times, it's written with the Yud. It's even Hashayat more on this, what the occasion, what the signs are, where they are. But anyway, there's a difference. Two of them has 9, but 11 they have backwards. That was, so the odd paper is called a Sefer Hihi. Right? Each paper was given the name by its textual problem. So each case they pulled 2 out of 3. Let me ask you a question. They had 3 Sefer Torah. When they made their new Sefer Torah, which Sefer Torah did it look like exactly? None. Right, not the 3. Not one of the 3 looked like the final copy. Right, now this obviously presents a problem with that a narrow reading of the Rambam Dei Pitur, or I think it's an incorrect reading. Chazal already know this. Now, you could argue, you know, when the Maturi Alfi wrote, and then the Lamdani here will forgive me for the moment, but Akhra Alfi wrote doesn't determine truth. It determines halach. When you determine something based upon a rote, it doesn't mean that's the way it is. It just means that Allah tells you to do. And if you don't believe me, you learn the end of your day, and you know that the one chunk of kosher, 2 kosher salami, and 1 chunk of trei salami, okay, according to a minority opinion of Rishon, so that's firstly the middle of the rote. According to a minority opinion of Rishon, we don't pass it this way, one person can eat all 3. And according to, I believe, conceptive stock, different people can eat each one of them. Even one person can eat, and a one person can eat 2. Certainly can eat 3. Now, clearly somebody ate a nice, delicious, juicy tasting piece of salami. Right? And smutta. That's not about truth. It's about halacha. It's 2 different issues. It's not truth versus false. It's just, they speak to 2 different issues. One is about what you do. One of them is about called historical truth, absolute truth, whatever it is. They're not related. They don't have to be related. It shouldn't disturb. You should just realize that Allah is pretty clear about that. So, from a historical perspective, clearly, determining a sacred Torah based upon a rote doesn't mean that's the Moshe Rabbeinu's sacred Torah. It's a hasra. And you can know what's the right. Now, what is the probability? Well, let's assume that you had, you want to use the sacred Torah to determine the probability your text looks like Moshe Rabbeinu's text. Okay, so it's possible that this hybrid Sefer Torah looked like Moshe Rabbeinu's text, but based upon the data available, what is the probability of that? Assuming that these were the only 3 words that were issued within the Torah, what is the probability of accepting Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah? Very basic, very minimal here. The probability is 8 over 27. 2/3, and then there's half, right? If only had 1 variance and you chose, let's say you only had 1 problem, that's okay, you chose an RA, just the Sefer Torah had that. The probability that this is Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah is 2/3. Okay, combine that with another 2/3 probability and another one, that's what you wind up with. Now, you realize, I'm not disturbed by this, I don't know if it ever disturbed me, it shouldn't disturb you either, but you realize that if you had 20 variants, you could discover 20 variants from the text of Chazal, that the probability of the Torah being exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu says the Torah is
very similar.
Right. It's like say between Slim and Nun and Slim and Left Half. Now what does that mean for us? It's nothing, because halacha doesn't say, the halacha is to present a sacred Torah based upon I will not create a sacred Torah should be written. Not a problem at all. Now, except the Shamigdariya claims that you can't become instituted sacred Torah, which he says you can't, because all the sacred from Leah and Atheris and so on, putting that sheet aside, it's disturbed to many other people. Now, the essential was that most things, you know, when you're not Miyaki Ro, that's Akhrab, and then you see a sacred Torah, and perhaps the Atheris is here from possible sacred Torah. Yeah, I'm sure.
But that changes those two things differently more than a lot.
So you're saying that it doesn't matter. So I warn you here, you're treading on very thin ground in terms of the AT car, even on the custom of it also. Because the Ram, what the AT car is not about picking and selecting some part of what's important and not important. This God said. That's a secret Ram Dhamma, right? In other words, we don't, in principle, we shouldn't really care whether or not it's a narrative or whether or not it's a halakh. Shouldn't matter. Although, you will see later, two individuals make a distinction. One which is not problematic, and I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong, but if it's problematic, the Rashba said something similar to what you said, but it's not really problematic, you understand why you said what you said. We're not going to see that today. That's in line with art, which you should. Is it in line with art? Where is it?
Somebody has my syllabus.
I feel somebody's syllabus for a second.
Is this your one?
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm off. I study in kind of stuff. I'll do my best to make sure before the end of it, it's in my box, unreserved. Otherwise, you can read the Maori article, which is a full article, and he quotes a lot of Lyman stuff there. And thanks for it. What's that?
Reserve.
Reserve is on the second floor, behind the desk. Can I see? I hope you should get to know that really soon if you're in college. Okay, book set. That they don't want to take out of the library because everybody needs to go behind the second floor, behind the second floor, usually the second floor. There should be a box in my course on the second floor behind the desk. I hope it's not too depleted. And if it's not in my box, check Dr. Moshe Bernstein's box because they'll probably be there. Yes?
Will somebody leave out the hay in the home with the puzzle?
That's a separate question. That's a modern halakhic question. The answer to that question. It's a tricky one. I think the answer, according to the Minchas Chinuch, is it really should not be possible. We assume it's very written Chasen. According to the Meiri, it is possible because none of us can ever have it. It's not a valid tradition. Okay. But that I'm not interested. I may talk about that a little bit. I mean, we'll eventually get to that.
The words that Atika.
Yeah.
Isn't that what one of the Shin's Akedim changed that for the Table of Yeshiva?
Yes. It also appears there. It also appears there, but
maybe they got it from somewhere else, possibly.
I'd rather not speculate that now, because you're going to open a mild can of worms with that. I mean, look, obviously it's clear from the Sefer that there are varying texts in the Bayit Sheni period. There's a larger question of what the Septuagint elders, which whoever they were, given what the Septuagint is, what we have is the Septuagint, and there's no reason to assume it's been changed. Not too many Chazal's claims of changes appear there, and I think we would rather pretend that it was a mistaken legend of Chazal than assume that Septuagint was real, because we have much bigger problems if Septuagint was real. It was really a translation, an authorized translation by Chazal in the Hebrew text. You got much bigger tzaras. And let's just say it was a totally different Septuagint, but there are a lot of, that's a can of worms, let's not open that. But the bottom line, is that according to the Sefer, the variants in the text, okay, fine. What led to these variants? Some of them are understandable. The Ona and Pizzi are easy to understand. That could be, I have absolutely no idea. The only suggestion I can make is something that Professor Lieberman once suggested, which is that there were things called vulgar texts and official texts. That the official text and the temple text, the Sefer HaZara, which seem to be, but these are not called Sefer HaZara, they're Nimsu Bazar. There is one or two places in the Chazal where you have something called Sefer HaZara, maybe the official text. And maybe the people copied for their own study purposes. It's not, you know, they didn't have printed text, so it's not like you had Sefer Torah to read from and Mitzvah Sefer Torah and then your own printed books to learn Chumash from. It was one and the same. You see that in Chazal also, the issue of writing individual Sfarim, they weren't getting about Samah HaMalach. So assuming that people who were popular texts, what we call vulgar texts, not in a negative connotation, just popular, it's a vulgar meaning, common. And maybe these variants somehow got into, crept back into other more important texts or something like that. Maybe that's how it happened. But human beings are human beings. They make errors as hard as they try. Finding two print things that come out before the days of computers that have the exact same text, and I'll give you a prize. Can you want? Because inevitably errors are going to creep in. With computers already, you can probably, you know, scientifically make sure there are people. You can't guarantee that no errors starting out in certain text because proofreaders may miss it. But once you establish a few puts on a computer, you can rest assured that it's probably all going to be identical. Barring parity errors. We'll talk about, I don't know, you know what parity errors. Okay. I'll talk about parity errors in computers when we get to Bali Sora and the purposes of mathematics. But anyway, so that's what the Sifrei says. Now, the Radak and the Abravanel had a debate about Craig Sifs. What was their debate about? What do you think about Craig Sifs? Yeah, what did Radak and the Abravanel say? I'm not sure anybody has seen it, so you're only going to be guessing what they said. And while you could probably read this very quickly, you can't read the Radak that quickly, and the Abravanel certainly can't read that quickly. So I may not go much further, but I'll still talk about it a little bit, and then we'll stop with this. But next time, please be a little further along. Okay, what is the what do you think about this?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
so hold on. I'll take you in a second. But there's someone who hasn't read it before, or before you read the other one, I've never read it. What do you think? Why do you think Craig's is of it? A little strange, right?
Yeah.
Well, that may be sometimes that may be the net effect. That may be the net effect. But why? Yeah, and we had Kirsch about that. So why do you have this? That, by the way, echoes something that Barbanel says, a little more radical than the way you said it. But why do we have Crane Sifs? Yeah. Ezra.
And because they knew that other word had to be there because of what they knew, like the general value of the Torah. But they just didn't change the text and they also changed the text.
Okay, so you're again, it's an Abarbanel-esque approach. Yeah, Adi? Okay, so that's my first response is sometimes I know it seems to be, you know, Lashon Nekiya. Oh, sometimes it's not actually. Sometimes it's the reverse. Some of the euphemisms used, or the changes made for human excrement, are actually more explicit in the Krei than in the Ksiv. But I think of Yishkalena and Yishkalena. Right? That's the one that comes to mind for me. Which is the euphemism, right? Yishkalena, shegol, is actually seems to be a reference to the sexual act, as opposed to Yishkalena, which is the typical biblical euphemism, right, for the sexual act, which is to lie with, right? We don't have to spell out in detail. That's what I always, that's why you sort of, if you caught me before having known the Radak and the Barbanel, so I never said, Kriksters are about that. Of course, the problem is there are a lot of Kriksters that don't exactly fit that model, right? So, what does the Radak say? Go ahead. So the Radak has a very interesting line. The Radak, you can open the Radak and look at a piece briefly. By the way, before you turn to the Radak, which is source 14, I just want to point out one thing in source 13, because some of you may never have seen this before. I'm not really going to explain how it works, but you look at the Sifrei, you'll notice something on the bottom. On the bottom right are basically, that you may have seen, they're basically notes, footnotes. The bottom left, that's sort of now an L-shaped section, is a critical apparatus. And what a critical apparatus does is give you manuscript readings. This is manuscript readings of the Sifrei. Sifrei is discussing variant readings of the Torah. The apparatus is giving you variant readings of the Sifrei. And basically the way that's usually done, I'm only pointing this out because most of you have probably never seen a critical text before. If you use the critical editions of the Mishonim, critical texts of the Mishonim, it's really footnotes. You don't get a single apparatus on the bottom. They selected the manuscript. They occasionally have a note about the Girsa. But basically, it's a critical text without an apparatus. But on the bottom, what you basically get, the way these work is you get a line number. If you take a look at the first paragraph opening, 3, that's the Shinun Vav, Simon Shinun Vav in the Sifrei, you get line 3, and then you get a word, Nimtzu. And if you see the word Nimtzu after the 3, that's the word, what's called a lemma,
from the line, if you look at the first line in Shin Nun Vav, line 3, the numbers are on the right side of the page. So you see the word Nimtzu, and then next to it, you have a variant which has manuscript Mem, I don't know the manuscripts of this Rei, has Niftachu, and then manuscript Hey that follows is Matsu, Gimel Tzifritar Matsu Bazar. Niftachu is a strange variant, but whatever. And then you get a little line, a break, that little, you know, straight thing up, and that means the next word. Okay, Echad Shalma Onim, and then you get the variance on that. Okay. Anyway, so that's the way a critical apparatus works. We're not doing anything more than Sefer, but be aware of that. The Radak, I will read the Radak, I'm not going to read the Barbanel. The Radak writes, Gav, firstly, there are three kinds of Krei Uksivs. There are three kinds of changes. There's Krei Velo Ksiv, Ksiv Velo Krei, and Krei Uksiv. We have a tendency to call them all Krei Uksiv. Krei Uksiv means it reads and it is written. Okay? Krei Velo Ksiv means, that's not a good term. Krei Velo Ksiv means it is read, but it is not written. Ksiv Velo Krei means it is written, but it is not read. In Hebrew, Ksiv Velo Krei, it's passive participle in Aramaic, which in Hebrew would be Kosuv Velo Nikra, or Velo Karoi, if there is such a word. So, Gan Echtov, the Radak writes, Gan Echtov Ta'am Kosuv Krei, Kosuv Velo Krei, Krei Velo Kosuv. What does Ta'am mean? No, it doesn't. No, not pronunciation, not reason. Somebody say something else? Sorry? Nope. When the Rishonim on Tanakh use the term bita'amo, they do not mean it's a reason. It's a reason may be related, but that's not what the word means. Ta'amo means its explanation. Not its cause, but when you want to explain words, ta'amo doesn't mean the reason. Later, so we use the term ta'am to mean reason, but he said ta'am means the interpretation, the perush. So when he says, when I am able to, kashar ufa lasseis ta'am l'shnem, when I can give a perush for both the Krei and the Ksiv, I'll explain the pasuk both ways. Where do these come from? So he writes, Venira kimilo sa'ela nimsu came the fish of the Golas Rishona, Ahu asvarim in Italu, Vachachamim Yodim, Yode Atorah Mesu, Vanshechnesa Gola, Shechzira Torah Yoshna, Masumach Locus Visvarim. They found disputes between the different Sifrei Torah, Vahoku Bohem Achar Harov, the Fidatum. What does that mean? They followed a row. What does the Fidatum mean? To the best of their knowledge. Let's see. Two read this way, one read the other way. Which do you think is more? Well, 10 out of 10 people surveyed think that 2 is more than 1. Actually, 9 out of 10 people. The one fellow, but we don't talk about him, thinks that 1 is more than 2. What do you mean, lefi datum? What does that mean? Yeah. All right, so it means evaluation of manuscripts. To give you an example, Chazal may not have been necessarily working with this. When you want to work on establish a critical version of a text, the best text possible, closest to what the original probably looked like, here's a basic rule. If you know that text B was made as a copy of text A and had no other sfarim that the scribe of text B worked with, anything B can basically be thrown in the garbage. If you have all the text A, you can just ignore text B. Because any readings that are found in text B that are different than text A were a product of the scribe that copied it, not a product of the original text. Maybe it's a better reading. Maybe it makes more sense. Maybe he guessed right. But in terms of establishing the history of a text and a critical text, if B is copied only from A, not with the help of any other sfarim, not an eclectic edition, not gathered from the manuscripts, you can toss B out of the window for the purpose of establishing a text. And that's A rule. Okay, now most texts don't necessarily work that way. You don't know that it's only copies from A. But okay, Lufidata means an evaluation of the manuscripts, of the scribe, the quality of the scribe. If any of you have done any Gemara manuscripts, you know, the famous manuscript of the Gemara is? Are you all here? Yeah. It's the most famous manuscript of the Gemara. Everybody knows about it. It's Ksav Yad Munich 95. The reason why it's famous is because it's the only Gemara manuscript that contains almost just about all of Shas. And Rav Rabinovich in the 19th century, when he did his Biktukei Sofer, he used that as the parallel to the Vilna printing. That was sort of his base manuscript that he compared the thing to. It happens to be, if you've ever worked with Ksav Yad Munich, you know that the scribe was a total incompetent. None of you writers have worked with him. I've worked with him, that's why I know. He misses lines all over the place. aside from his incessant tendency to abbreviate almost every word, which is very annoying if you're doing a critical edition, you have to note every other word. But he's terrible. He misses lines all over the place. He was not a very good scribe. Now, maybe he was a great scribe and wrote this manuscript in a rush. I don't mean that as a judgment for the person. I'm sure he was a very erudite yid. But bottom line is, the manuscript is a disaster. Now, it's useful. It doesn't mean it doesn't contain useful reading, but he was not, the job done on this manuscript wasn't very good. So you can sometimes, you look at a Sefer Torah. Now, it doesn't always tell you this, but if any of you have ever been involved in the purchasing of Sefer Torah or the Megillah, you look at the ksav and you can see which scribe is medactic and which who has a nice ksav and who has a fast, sloppy ksav. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean sometimes the sloppier ksav may still be more accurate, but there are lots of things that can tell you something about the nature of the scribe who did it. You know, whether he was really, whether he was a sofer or he was a boor. You know, so you can tell sometimes by various aspects. So I assume the fidata means there was an evaluation. It wasn't just a numeric, right? You have, you know, a lot of things that are copied, you know, a lot of copies made of one bad manuscript doesn't mean that that manuscript is now more important for the history of the text. Now, then he says, Uvamakam shelo hisiga datam ala birur, kasvo echad velo nitsu o naktu o kasvo nakutz velo kasvo nifnim. But, he says, when they could not be masig birur, then they would use krav siv to do what? To preserve both versions. Sometimes they would write one inside, but the tradition would be not to read it. Sometimes you would read it even though it's not written. And sometimes it would, they would write it one way, but they would establish a tradition to read it the other way. Now, were these crave, when they had a crave sib, were they written in the margin? No, why not, Benjamin? Because they didn't have a codex. The Abarbanel, and maybe even the Radak didn't realize this, that they didn't write in their Sfarim, they didn't write things in the margins. These were oral traditions of crave sib. Meaning, for the Radak theory, you have to say, it means they wrote it one way, but they transmitted an oral tradition to read the pasuk the other way, or to read a word that wasn't there, or to not read a word that wasn't. That's what you have to assume. So that's the Radak theory of crave sib. Now, we have a lot of crave sib, don't we? What's that? But only comes when we don't write in our Sefer Torah. When you have codices, in the Bali Masorah, in the 9th century, in the 8th, 9th century, and they're writing their codices of Tanakh, that's when they do it. And that transfers over to the printed Sfarim, the printed Tanakh. So according to the Radak, Krayv Siv is a result of textual corruption, of errors that crept into the text. So when Chazal could be Machriya, they were Machriya. When they couldn't be Machriya, they basically left as a Tzarechin. And the way they left the Tzarechin was Krayv Siv, or one or some member of that family. That's what the Radak says, yes. No, Ein Likra, no, Yesh Ein Lemikra, Yesh Ein Lemesoros, the Sugya in Sanhedrin Daf Dalin, and many other places in Shas, is not about what the text says. It's about how you halakhically interpret. There's a case where we know what the Kray is. It's a Chaser and a Yasser, a Kray of Siv, you could call it if you want that, but it's not really. Because when a word is written Chaser, but it's pronounced Male, or vice versa. Well, usually it's written Chaser and pronounced Male. So the question is, what is the halakhic interpretation follow? Does it follow primarily the mikra, does it follow the masoras? But that's not about crazy, that's not about textual corruption. There the assumption is it's supposed to be written a certain way. It happens to be, if you learn that sugya, you're going to run into some problems of textual variance. Look at the Ran on Karnos, and Rashi, and Rabbeinu Tam, and Totafos, and so on, and you'll see where that's some of the issue we're going to talk about in Lyman's piece and what we do in our Sefer Torah. But that's not a crazy submission, that's not a textual. The Gemara itself is not a problem, not a question of different texts. It's just how do you interpret halakhically? Okay, good. All right, I'd like to wish everyone